Accession number 21735, Rule 7.
Washington, Rule 7. You went out daily on the troll, as you were just about to tell me?
Yeah, the idea was that so once you've done your classroom training and all this different assessment, you then had to go out and get the feel of equipment and how it worked. And we went down to the jetties early in the morning, 4:30, it was still dark, onto trawlers. Now, these trawlers were kitted out as training ships, virtually. They had all the training equipment on board, ASIC. They even had the early radar warning systems fitted on, so radar training lads also went aboard. And we then sailed out into the north part of the RSC, and there they would have probably a training submarine out there, and our job was to try and find it. And it was very difficult to start with. You had to familiarize yourself with the equipment as it's fitted onto a boat. The other thing was you had to try to get to grips with the pitching and rolling of a trawler in those heavy seas. And some lads used to suffer badly. Luckily, I never did. With that feeling of seasickness. Now, if you've ever been seasick, you cannot concentrate. Your concentration goes, you just want to die. And so some of the lads had a bit of a struggle. But I found that by concentrating on what I was doing, it never worried me about being seasick. I was just one of those lucky people. But some did suffer rather badly. And there we spent pretty well all day circling round trying to pick up the submarine, and then they'd shoot off somewhere else and they'd probably spot a convoy coming through, and so we would head towards that convoy, and there you would transmit to try to identify the different type of engine noises, whether it was a reciprocating old coal burner or it was a diesel engine. And so all those things were kept in the training program.
How would you distinguish between the different engine noises?
Well, the old coal burning or reciprocation engines would go thump, 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 thump. You could hear that regular beat. Imagine those big screws they had. But the diesel engines were much faster revving engines, and so you could tell there was a faster engine noise there, and you could identify whether it was a diesel engine. Now, the thing is, say for instance you're transmitting it at night and the radar hasn't picked up any object, but you hear this diesel noise going, it could be a submarine running on the surface at night time. So these are the quick things you have to try to work out. I mean, when we did the training, the submarine would suddenly come to the surface, and then you'd have to track it, not with sight, but with sound, and see if you could identify that that was the submarine that you were tracking.
And what range would you have with the ASDIC while you were training?
Oh, 2,000 yards, 3,000 yards. It was a very, very. It depends when the ping goes out and you wait. If nothing comes back, empty sea, then you wait. And then if an echo comes back, you see you pause on each bearing till the ping goes out for a period of time. And if nothing happens, you just move on to the next bearing. Now, if the echo comes back, you can assess the time that the transmission went out to the time the echo came back. You can assess that with range. And so you knew that the target was 3,000 yards, 4,000 yards, something like that.
And you did mention when you were describing the ASDIC that it could pick up underwater obstacles.
Yeah.
How would they be distinguished, and did you have any practice on that when you were training?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of the trawler skippers knew where the main shoals of fish were. So they just to throw you, they take you out through there, and then they say, OK, start transmitting on such and such a bearing. So you transmit, and you pick up these echoes, and then you know, submarine, you see, and they switch on the sonar, and you hear this funny popping noise, like a little fuzzy pop, 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 pop. And these were fish. It was a shoal of fish. And so you can imagine if you charged into amongst that shoal of fish and dropped a few depth charges, you'd waste an awful lot of rations, wouldn't you? No, so they tried to simulate as much different undersea noises as they possibly could. Or they'd head towards some rocky outcrop, and you transmit there, and you had to check whether you're hitting land or whether the object's moving, you see. So, I mean, if you hit an object with on one bearing on the time and it's not moving, it's certainly not a ship. So, therefore, you can still... I mean, it was also used for echo sounding. You could sound depth as well. I mean, later on, towards the end of the war, we went down through the Tasmanian Sea. And it's very, very tricky around there because of the depths and the changing of depths. And we were using echo sounding for a day and a half, plotting a course through the Tasmanian Sea. So it uses echo sounding as well for depth control.
You mentioned the skippers of the trawlers, mm. where the shoals of fish were.
Yeah.
Who were the skippers? No.
The skippers of the trawlers were mainly civilians. They would have a naval officer on board, obviously, to ensure that you had naval discipline, and the fact that the boat had been requisitioned by the Navy. But in the main, the skippers were civilian skippers. Great characters. Always had plenty of cups of tea on board when they were there.
So with this training, you describe the various aspects of it. How long did that continue for?
I think it was 6 weeks. That's all we had, 6 weeks. You can imagine the speed they had to turn us out. They couldn't afford longer, but they still assessed you. If you didn't pass at the end of your exam, at the end of your assessment, if you didn't pass your necessary qualifications, you were kept back for another session. But I think I did 6 weeks and went through, and they said, okay, transfer you now, and wait for about 2 or 3 days until you're seconded onto a ship.
Did you feel confident with your own abilities after that period?
Oh, yes. I think I felt fairly confident. Because I felt at ease with the ASDIC training. I was fairly confident that I would pass. I was fairly confident.
Do you think one of the aspects of being an ASDIC operator, do you think it's a skill that people have, or is it an aptitude that they have?
I think it must be a bit of both, actually. I've always been useful with my hands. I love making things. I mean, I could, 10 years old, I'd strip an engine off a motorbike and rebuild it. So I had an aptitude for that side of things. And, of course, I had a fairly quick aptitude for grasping things. Luckily, once I was told something, I could retain that. And also, I was interested in it. I wanted to do it. And so I think I found it very, very easy as regards the lecture work and the assessment part of it at the end. So I think I was fairly comfortable with that.
And how important is physical and mental coordination?
It is very, very important, because if you're slow in reaction physically, you're going to be slow in reaction mentally. And you can imagine climbing up and down those ladders and running like mad to your action stations. You had to be physically fit. There's no doubt about that. And, of course, the other thing is, you being shut down in that compartment, if you had an inclination to be claustrophobic, you were absolutely useless. You'd be no good down there. It's all right if you're in a destroyer where your transmission cabinet is on the upper bridge, but in a cruiser, you're right down below. And so you had to be physically fit to be able to sustain that 4 hours on, 4 hours off, down in that confined space, and as I say, running up and down those ladders. Yeah, and I think that again is part. If you're not physically fit, you can't be mentally alert, and I think that's the important thing to remember.
So what happened next? You'd been assessed and you'd done your 6 weeks.
Yeah, you're putting into a holding section, and we were sent to HMS Osprey, which was another land-based requisition school, up in Dunoon. And I was only up there, I suppose, for a week, that's all. There, we didn't do much training because it was a holding camp, but I do remember having to do guard duties on the gates and things like that, and around the barracks. And then you waited there, I think, for about 4 days, I think it was.
And then, about September time.
Yeah, no, yeah. And you were called in. They said, right, we've got a draft for you. And I was drafted to a French destroyer, the Lacomprise. I thought, what the heck am I doing on a French destroyer? And it turned out, I think it was one that they'd more or less requisitioned from the Free French Navy. And they had no ASDIC operators, and they only had the basic equipment on, and they were fitting this one out with equipment, and I had to virtually go up to Rosyth and help to install this equipment, because that's the other thing you had to train to do, actually install equipment and repair it. And then we sailed on there on a convoy escort duty on the Lacomprise. That was the first ship I went on to.
With this, you've been drafted to a French ship. You said about installing equipment. How did you go about installing the new ASDIC equipment on board?
Well, you see, they kept upgrading the equipment. Obviously, as things got more sophisticated, they could upgrade and make them more efficient. But when we arrived there, there was two of us, and there was all this equipment stacked in boxes on the bridge, unopened. And the chief petty officer there said, "There's the ASDIC equipment. You've got to install it in that room there." You can imagine, we had it stuck all over the place. There was no proper racking for it, but we managed to link it all together so that it worked, and we managed to fit up the cabinet on the wall, on the bulkhead, and with the transmission equipment. And then we had to go down below to find out where we could fit the oscillator. Luckily, it did have a dome in there, but there was no oscillator. We managed to fit an oscillator, and to wire it between there and up onto the bridge. We had cables everywhere, trailing all up the walls, ran the gangway, and of course, every now and again, the equipment would go off because somebody pulled a cable or tripped over. Absolute chaos. But anyway, we eventually got it more or less sorted out. And but you see, that was difficult because there was only two of us, and when you think that you've got to be able to sleep and eat, so we used to do 2 hours on, 2 hours off between us all the time. That got a bit tiring towards the end until they managed to get a couple of more operators to come on board. But as I say, we were very, very short all around the fleet for ASDIC operators.
How long did it take to install?
About 3 days, I think. About 3 days. I think the last day of fitting was at sea. We were at sea when we did the last bit of the fitting up.
You say she was a French vessel?
Yeah.
And she'd been requisitioned? Yeah,
yeah.
Was it a Royal Naval crew?
Yeah, 50-50. We had some Free French on there as well. But it was very difficult, actually. It wasn't an easy task. We had a Lieutenant Commander, Royal Navy, on the bridge, and we had a French Lieutenant on the bridge. But the Chief Petty Officer used to tear his hair out sometimes at the antics of some of the French crew, but eventually we managed to knit together as a good unit in the end. Our discipline and our love for cleanliness got through to them in the end, and we became a good unit. We became a good unit.
You've mentioned cleanliness on board the ship before.
Mm.
What was it like when you first went on board? And how did it differ from the old naval
club? It was pretty ropey. The first thing I think we did, we stripped everything out of our little mess deck that we were given. And we scrubbed it from top to bottom. I remember the smell of onions and garlic. Oh, but anyway, we got it clean. And the French matelots, they were very good in the end. They came to respect us. And we didn't deride them or anything like that. But we just said, clean that. Clean it. Wash it. And so we eventually became a good unit because I think it rubbed off. Our chief petty officer used to tear his hair out at times, but we got round to they came round to our way of thinking that it was much more comfortable to live in clean conditions than the way they were. And those blessed French cigarettes, God, stench of those. So we gradually weaned them onto Woodbines, I think, in the end.
I mean, I'm just surprised, obviously, with naval tradition. You assume that naval tradition is the same across.
Well,
the world.
You would think so, but I think I don't know whether it's well, the Royal Navy tradition has always been with cleanliness. Even the days of the wooden ships, they were very, very strict on hygiene because. Otherwise, you get scurvy and Lord knows what. I think a lot of the Continentals were a little bit slap happy, and when it was their time to sit down and have a rest, that was it. You sat there and had a rest. You didn't do any cleaning, any make and mend or anything like that. But I think gradually, towards the end of the war, I think a lot of the naval units, particularly. They got together and they became very, very closely involved in naval tradition and how it should be.
Because I'm wondering at this stage as well, because it's 42, you've got these three French sailors. Mm. What was their attitude to the war? Was it different from your own?
No, I think theirs was more intense. Don't forget that their families were still in occupied territory. And they had no time for Patan, and people that went on to became working with the Germans or anything like that. They didn't want to know. No, they didn't want to know. They were very intense that the quicker we got this thing over, the better it would be. Because remember, their families were still in Germany occupied territory.
And what was the character of the ship?
It was a very old. Very old destroyer. I mean, some of the equipment I don't think would ever work. I mean, if a fire hydrant was necessary, I don't think you could ever turn the handle. There's too much paint on it. I mean, they didn't bother too much about maintenance, but it was quite an old. I think it must have been built around about the 1920s. I would have thought it's very, very old. But no, we eventually got it working. But it used to creak and groan, and it was the only ship that I'd been on where, if you were tied up alongside in a dockyard, you had to keep the bilge pumps running to stop it sinking. It was as I think the plates creaked all over the place. But
you said you were still installing on the first day you went to sea on the
ship. Yeah.
Can you describe? That first?
Well, the first couple of days installing this equipment, we kept having. In the end, we didn't bother to go and ask permission to go here or go there or put it here because it was a waste of time. And then they'd stop all these arguments, you can't put it there. So in the end, we said, look, we'll just run the cables through, poke it through there, poke it through that air vent, drop it down there. Oh, that's the skipper's cabin. Never mind, he won't know. Put it down through there. And so that's we had to do it because we had to get this thing installed. We were already sailing in a convoy. We had no equipment going. But we did eventually get it going, and luckily enough, it worked first time.
Did you get a chance to test it on?
Oh, yeah, we used it straight away. As soon as we got it connected up, we used it straight away, and we kept the watch duties going then. And we had, of course, we had then, of course, the repeaters up on the bridge. And so the skipper would poke his head round the door, and he thought that was fantastic. You know, he'd see something, he'd hear something. So they thought that was great, you know. Really great.
I'm wondering, you know, ASDIC, as you say, it's been upgraded gradually as the war goes on.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's the first time it's been installed on that.
Yeah, yeah.
Your skipper's reaction, what was the reaction of the crew to the...
Oh, they thought it was fantastic, because now they knew that at least we've got some protection. Of course, the biggest fear... In those days, well, not from the attack from the surface ships, because we knew that the German Navy had kept itself right out of the way. They didn't want to risk their ships. Bombers and air raids, okay, they were a threat, but at least you can see them. You can look at a target, you can aim for it, you can shoot at it. But people were hearing about the U-boat war, and that's a target you can't see. So when they realised that we'd got the ASDIC working, they realised at least we've got something, we can at least hear it. And I think that gave a lot of confidence to the general crew that we had some submarine detection equipment, and at least we could hear if there's going to be a threat to our sort of the convoy. And I think that psychologically, I think feelings changed a bit on board. Trepidation went from that unseen killer.
And how did the rest of the crew look on you two?
Well, they thought it was great. They thought we were brilliant. You know, I mean, they if we came up off watch, the first thing they said, "Carl, come and have a cup of tea." I mean, they were, you know, they were, yeah, good lads, you know. I mean, they couldn't do enough for us, you know. But they thought it was great fun.
And
we used to take them up on the bridge and show them, let them put the earphones on, and so they knew exactly what we were doing, you know, and what we were listening to.
Because it sounds like you had a certain amount of autonomy. You were almost your own bosses in some respects.
Oh, well, you had to be. You had to be. Because in that particular case, we had to install the equipment, and we had to maintain the equipment, and if something went wrong, we'd have to repair it. You didn't have to go and ask permission to do this or do that. You load the equipment, you get and do it. You know, the only time we had to ask permission is to raise or lower the dome, because that depends on the ship's speed. So we had to ask permission from the bridge to either lower or raise the dome.
So you sailed from Rosyth?
We sailed from Rosyth, but then, of course, we operated from all over the place. Lowestoft, Liverpool, Scapa Flow, wherever we were sent, we operated from.
Well, I was thinking of that first time when you sailed out on convoy.
Oh, yeah.
Where did you go from Rosyth?
Ran north of Scotland through the Pentland Firth. Now, that's where the North Sea meets the North Atlantic. And I would suppose it's the roughest piece of water around the British Isles, because it just doesn't roll. It pitches, tosses, turns. And it's like trying to drive a canoe through a whirlpool. And it's quite horrendous, really. We ran the Pentland Firth and picked up a convoy off the north coast of Ireland. That was the first time. And sailed with it up to Reykjavik. It was an American convoy, coming in from America, rather. And sailing it up to Scapa Flow, and then up to Reykjavik in Iceland, where... We then had to take it up to Murmansk in Russia.
So in the section between Scapa Flow and Reykjavik, was there any incidents that you remember on that first stage?
No, I don't think so. No. Because if you remember, at that particular time, the majority of the U-boat wolf packs were out in the Atlantic trying to cut off supplies from America. And it was later on that they started to infiltrate through the Arctic to cut off the supplies going to Russia.
Had you any inkling that you were going to go on there onto a Russian convoy?
No. They don't tell you until after you've left to pick up the convoy, and then you're told. Obviously, the fleet commanders know, but it's only when you're well out at sea, and then the skipper will come over the tannoy and tell you what our trip's going to be.
So theoretically, you could be going anywhere.
could be gone anyway. Oh, yes, you could. Oh, yeah. I mean, quite honestly, a lot of fleet commanders don't know where they're going until they put to sea and open their sealed orders.
So were there any preparations? Obviously, if you're going up into the Arctic, even at that time of year, would you have needed cold weather clothing? Or
what cold weather clothing? No, it's a little bit different now. I mean, you had your basic seaman training and your basic seaman's kit. If you're going on sea duties, then you have your duffel coat and probably a pair of, if you're lucky, a pair of sea boots. And that's it. I mean, you just put on as many clothes as you could get over your kit bag and put your duffel coat on with your hood up, and that was your winter clothing. But of course, it's a little bit more sophisticated now. But I don't think we knew much what the elements were going to be like much at those time. And of course, the other thing is, in that time, you still had the rum ration, which you don't get now. And so 11 o'clock in the morning, you could up spirits and you could pull your balaclava down one part, push your goggles up on another, tip your hood back. In the gap in between, tip the tip your tot of rum, then shut everything up quick to keep the heat in. Oh, yeah, that's... No, we had no other heavy equipment. Well, it gradually got better later on.
So you sail from Reykjavik onto...
Up towards Murmansk, well, up to Bear Rock. And then the Russian trawlers would come out and take over. And then we'd wait for an empty convoy, probably another one coming back.
Can you remember the number of that first convoy you went up with at all?
Oh, gosh, no, I can't remember now.
Were there any incidents that occurred?
Not on that convoy. No, not on that convoy. No. The majority of incidents occurred later on when I transferred to the Belfast. But before that, there weren't many incidents. One or two. We used to get one or two of the... German Condors used to fly out from Norway, and they were long-range long-range aircraft, and they were coming out spotting for convoys, looking for likely targets to bring in their Stuka dive bombers or something like that. But we managed to evade them, because you remember, at that time of the year up there, there's very, very little daylight. There's nearly everything is in semi-darkness, all pitch black, all heavy seas, so it wasn't conducive to an air attack. So we were fairly lucky, fairly lucky. The only thing we had to watch for, of course, was submarines, because if you get a submarine pack within a convoy, you've got trouble.
And you were still operating your 2 hours on?
Yeah, two hours on, 2 hours off. And that was the first trip. Second trip was all right, because we had another two ladders came aboard, and that eased the situation.
Because I was wondering, on that first trip, you must have... What do you feel most? Do you feel fatigue or tiredness, or both?
I think it was fatigue, because I think also, because of the long hours, it was the intense cold. And this is something that brings on fatigue quicker than anything else. I mean, if we'd been in the tropics area for some reason, I think we could have lasted much better, 2 hours on, 2 hours off. But with the intense cold, you never ever seem to get warm. And so you became very, very tired. And once or twice, you felt like nodding off. And this is, so by putting a little tiny bleep on our equipment, you could hear this every now and again and make you keep awake. But